Great Economic Committee of the Senate to order at this time. Today's date is April 28, 1999. I'd like to open at this time a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 22. So why don't you give us what this essay is about?
Yes.
1 minute.
SCR 22, Mr. Chair and members, is the sign bill. We have, however, amendments to this bill, which should be in your packet.
Okay, what the amendment says?
And the amendment actually replaces the entire bill.
Okay.
So the amendment provides that signs shall be placed, it directs Department of Transportation to place a sign at each interstate highway entrance to Oregon, and these signs shall say, "Welcome, keep Oregon green."
Okay, what happened in the word, "Welcome, please don't say"? What happened that there?
Mr. Chair, those were voted down. They were not very well received.
Right?
So we did a replacement.
Okay, so we are coming from negative to positive, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and who is here from the Department of
Transportation? Transportation?
Yes, would you please come and please state your name?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Goulet, and I'm the Deputy Director and Chief Engineer at ODOT.
Okay.
And it's our understanding that as amended, the bill would specify signs only at the interstate entrances, and there are five of them. Interstate 5 north and south, Interstate 84 as it enters westbound, 82 as it enters southbound, and I-205 again as it enters southbound.
Okay.
And we've done an estimate of the cost to modify our signs at those five locations. And depending on the best way to make that modification, the cost would not exceed $8,000.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I missed the price.
$8,000.
That's the maximum amount that we could use. It could be less.
It could be less. Sure. Okay. It would depend on the best way to get it done. And once we have a chance to analyze more thoroughly, we could move ahead.
Mr. Chair, that would be the best spent hospitality money I can think of.
Thank you. And do you believe you can observe this amount in your current budget, if possible?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any questions from the members? No, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Is there any other spoken like to testify on SJR 22? If not, we will close up the hearing SJR 22. And we're ready to open the line back in.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR.
Then we'll open it first.
Oh.
I'd like to open SJR 22.
Are we in a hurry or what?
I think so, because we have a lot of bills, if possible, we need to save time.
Well, let me pause and catch my breath here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordon moved the SJR 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And do we need to have amended?
As amended.
As amended.
Very definitely. Very definitely.
I don't care if you get sued on
the
chair, but I need to get sued on
it. Okay. You want amendment to that?
Yes.
How do I?
So we have to move the.
I think we need to move the one amendment first.
Okay.
Is there any objection that the dash one amendment of this year 22? If not, it's adopted. And then now we that the Senator Gordon already moved.
So move.
Okay. Any discussion? Do you believe this is a good thing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I really believe you should carry this on the floor.
Okay, let's discuss that after that. Okay, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Corcoran?
Only if the Irish, if the green in this is Irish green, then I'm a yes.
Okay.
All right?
It could be.
Okay, I'm a yes.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher? Senator Gordon.
Aye.
Aye. Let's have a Senator Fisher. Senator Fisher, we need your vote here. It's HR 22, which is a sign bill that you're welcome to come, don't stay, but we are changing the sign.
Welcome to come and keep us
safe. And welcome, keep Oregon green, that's a change.
As long as it doesn't say orange. I haven't had a chance to.
Can I see you, Mike?
Sure.
I think if you carry this bill, Mr. Chair, it will improve your image.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with my image?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it will. I think it will make you appear more friendly. And you are. We know it.
Okay.
There were some who may have doubted it. See, I think this will make it.
You may have meant your reputation with, like, every convention bureau in Portland.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You're about 40 or 50 years behind Washington.
Okay.
They've had signs painted on their highways all over Washington all back through the year to keep Washington green, so.
Okay, I think we will. We'll make our five
possibly.
Okay. Okay. So, yes vote?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Mexico is just keep it
current. It's say 22 as amended is passed, and I'm going to close the work session of say 22. Is there a volunteer to carry this bill?
Oh, allow me.
Will you?
I'd be happy to. Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't increase the chances of it succeeding.
Okay.
But I'm happy to do it, Mr.
So what I'm proposing, why don't you be with your core sponsor.
I'm happy to do that.
Okay.
With you. Yeah.
I'm worried about the image of the bill now.
Okay. What do you want it to say? Keep it gray? So what I'm trying to do is say that the program will help me change my image. That's what I'm looking for.
You know, being next to me, Mr. Chair, can only be an improvement to your image.
Okay. Okay, and I'd like to open a public hearing, Senate Bill 952, and that the caravan to give us what the 952 does.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 952 is a bill that creates a commission to work toward bringing Olympic Games to Oregon at some time in the future. There are amendments to this bill which we probably will discuss tomorrow.
Okay, tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But we do have one witness who has come to provide some information.
What was his name?
Mr. John Mercado.
Okay, Mr. John Mercado, I do appreciate your time to come out to testify, and I do appreciate it. Would you give us your name and where you're from? Or
right. I'm John Mercado. I'm here at the request of the committee that gave me a call yesterday. Fortunately, I work over at Western Oregon University in beautiful downtown Monmouth, and I'm the chief fundraiser over there. I'm also the mayor of Independence, but I'm sitting in front of you today as a board member of the United States Olympic Committee, and I can pass on some information that may be helpful for this, and then, although any opinions I express on the bill are my own opinions and do not represent the Olympic Committee, now that I've got all the
issues here. Senator
Fisher,
do you have a few deals for us here?
I'm still bigger than you.
I was not going to brag on you, but the heck with you. I want to know where the...
In light of some of the problems we've been having over in Salt Lake City, I wanted to make sure we were going to keep
that on
the
well. And the Mormons. Think about that.
That's hard to do.
You have a lively committee here, Senator.
Sometimes they are carried over.
Carried over.
I'd like to give you about 5 minutes of general information that I think will be of assistance to the committee. The United States Olympic Committee has two major functions. One is to prepare the athletes and send the athletes of the United States to the Olympic and Pan American and World University Games. It also presents the big city from the United States to the international body and oversees the conduct of the games that take place within the United States. As you, I'm sure, are aware, the Olympics are the coveted prize in the sports world. It is It's huge. It has a huge economic impact. It also has incredible international prestige associated with it. It is the creme de la creme of what every country in the world aspires to, is to host an Olympic game. I will tell you that the process to host the summer or winter Olympic games is an extremely long process. I secured some information last night via fax from the Olympic Committee, and with a proposed timeline that I'd be happy to share with the committee at a later date, but it starts off 15 years in advance. Start with a bid committee, and that's just to get started. The process, the United States is considering bidding for the 2008-2012 Olympic Games, Summer Games, and that process is already, the cities have already been selected, so that process is now closed and is moving forward. So we are talking approximately a 30-year window here. The size of the Olympic Games is very large. We're talking about 10,000 athletes from 199 countries are what are expected in Sydney. It costs $2 billion in direct financing to put the games on, not counting related infrastructure that goes into that. And I think the number for Salt Lake is approximately $1.2-1.5 billion in related funding in freeways and other infrastructure construction. But all is not dark here. I'd like to suggest that we all know what the economic impact of sport can be. And the International Olympic Committee and the U.S. Olympic Committee recognize that, but what they're also interested in is sport infrastructure, is the sport development and facility legacies that can remain after the event takes place, because you always want more than just good memories. You want something. And that's one of the big things that Salt Lake has done so very well, is the built-in infrastructure that, and I will tell you just one short story. The day the ski jump opened in Salt Lake, the number of registered ski jumpers in the United States quadrupled in one day. There are a number of other competitions, events, and activities within the sporting world that Oregon can benefit from, and that could also put the state in a position to become part of the Olympic family. The Pan American Games, the World Youth Championships, the World Student Games, these are all major Olympic-style events. The other thing that happens is there are 40-some sports within this country who have a variety of national championships, regional championships, youth championships, and senior championships. And let me tell you that when you talk economic development, we can talk about the Junior Olympics that takes place with 6,000 kids, plus approximately 10 to 12,000 parents and other adults that come with them. You can see very quickly that those kind of numbers make visitors and convention bureaus extremely excited. So I would suggest that while the Olympic Games are the creme de la creme, and it is wonderful to work towards that, I think there's value in working towards hosting a number of other kinds of athletic events in this state. At the regional, national, and international level. The bill you have in front of you suggests a modest investment, but it also suggests something that's also equally important, and that's a policy statement made by the state of Oregon. By your investment in that, that makes a major policy statement that says the state of Oregon is interested in hosting these kinds of activities. It would support the efforts of the Portland Metropolitan Sports Authority, which is expanding outside the metro area. I do have a couple of suggestions, if I could, potential amendments. One thing that might open up your opportunity is to change the title of the Olympic references to the Olympic Sports Commission, which would open up your opportunities to the 40-plus Olympic and Pan-American sports. Would not necessarily just tie it to specific Olympic Games, but would still put that five-ring connection. And I think that would really clarify, open up the opportunity to Olympic Games. And instead of me talking, I will be happy to respond to questions from the committee chair or provide anything else that I can.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Fisher.
You were saying that they start 15 years in advance. My edition says 2010. We're already about 3 years too late. What's the You were talking about working on something for 30 years.
Yes, Senator, members of the committee. The we are currently going for the 2012 games right now. And there are, if I recall correctly off the top of my head, the cities that are involved for 2012 are Dallas-Fort Worth. If they could recall, because a bunch of people are on parole there. Washington, Baltimore, Houston, I believe, the LA area, major metropolitan area. One of the other things that happens is that it just isn't the United States. It's within the world context, they like to get the Olympics around. China is very interested in holding it in Beijing. South Africa is very much interested in a number of countries around the world. So once you've had it, an Olympics in the United States, let's say if we were lucky enough to get 2012 by some, it would take another 20 years before they would land another Olympic Games here because of the international politics and the desire to move around. So, and it is an inexact science.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we've got a 2010 lock all the way through here. If we're shooting for 2012, why we got 2010?
I think we
got our amendment here. Okay. It's the whole thing.
I have the benefit, Senator, of some handwritten amendments and suggestions that I think you folks are going to deal with later on, and so I accepted those as a statement.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair. I generally don't share privileged information between legislators, but a elderly gentleman at the table up here sent me a note that says, look at me, this is you in 15 years. Will you drive by and pick me up in my wheelchair and take me to the Olympics in Oregon? I have a question for Mr. McArdle.
Yes, sir.
I have a serious question and then an also serious question. The serious question is, what do you make of the discussion that's been going on about the fact that one of the potential penalties of the U.S. Olympic Committee is that they may remove their current tax status, and which would be a disincentive for corporate sponsorship of the Games? Do you think that's potentially could happen?
The President of the United States Olympic Committee just recently testified in front of the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee on that specific issue. There was some interest at that point of looking at removing the International Olympic Committee's tax incentive, tax deductions, special considerations. There are some interesting factors associated with that. One is that the way the contracts are written, all that would have done is charge NBC more money. And would not have netted anybody anything else because NBC would have had to pay more. The committee has since decided not to do anything at that point, at this point. With the challenges that have happened at the international level, the United States Olympic Committee has asked the President of the United States to include the IOC as one of the world organizations that is in the that's covered by the anti-bribery rules at the federal level. So we feel that that'll take care of a lot of those kinds of challenges. And I would say, since we've kind of brought some of these issues up, that the USOC has been has moved forward very aggressively to take care of some of the challenges that you've read about in the paper. And as we all know, not everything in the paper is exactly the way things are. And there's a major international reform commission, which includes Henry Kissinger and Peter Ubarov, who ran the 84 games, and others. To make recommendations for change at that organization beginning in January of 2000.
Well, Mr. McArdle, I really, for my two cents on the, sort of observing this from a distance, I read a discussion in Sports Illustrated about a potential move within the Olympics to allow ex-athletes, larger voice in the process, and my two cents is that that makes a hell of a lot of sense to me. Instead of having these sort of professional, representatives of the various countries and the potential for the problem. So you can take that forward to me as a recommendation. The other thing is, will you share with the committee what your experience in the Olympics were?
I was a member of the 1980 Olympic team. I'm a hammer thrower. I grew up here in Salem, and I competed internationally in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and I just retired about 3 years ago, although...
So I've had some success and I've had the pleasure of representing the United States internationally, and I guess that's why I speak to with so much passion in front of you today.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you might have the also Olympic body, you have a political body in Norway.
Sure. I don't know if I like you bringing these threatening guys up there. I don't mind by throwing a hammer at me.
Yeah, you might have to talk outside together, I guess. Okay, since this was time is the essence, I think we will move along, but before we do that, thank you very much, John, for coming over. And we have our amendments. Explain to us what our amendments are.
We have this bill scheduled as tomorrow's hearing as well.
Yeah.
The amendment changes the language, as Mr. McArdle suggested, so that it is not limited to the 2010 games, because our last public hearing made it clear that we were way behind times in making that kind of an effort. It also assigns the responsibility to the Portland Sports Authority, and they helped work out the amendments so that the director of this commission would be a part of their staff and employed by them, and they would provide the administrative support. Mm-hmm. Their mission very much is a meld with the mission that's set out in this bill, and I think it will be ready to write testimony for the committee tomorrow, explaining the amendments.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Does that also change the $300,000 with it? Or is that included still continued on?
It's included.
Excuse me.
$300,000.
That's not a part of it. However, the amendments would allocate $150,000 for a biennium to pay the salary of one full-time employee for 2 years.
So it's considerable.
Yeah. It's sure we are sensitive on the amount.
Ask a question as a witness?
Sure.
Just requiring your passion for the Olympics and your native bias, do you think, as a member of the commission, that Oregon would be a likely candidate for the Olympic Games 15 years or 20 years since?
There are a lot of factors that go into that. We could be. It depends upon the commitment from the private sector and the city. If you're talking about the Summer Olympic Games, the average main stadium that opening ceremonies and such place in seats 84,000 people.
84,000?
Yes. And I have the detailed information if you're interested. The big book, by the way, is 300 pages. We might be able to consider a winter opportunity. 30 years is an awful long way for any of us to try to look out. And that's why I suggested that it might be more than 30 years, it might be 60 years to land the Olympic Games, because many of the places have been competing for years and years and years to situate themselves. But I do think that we have an opportunity to host a major international competition, major sports competition in the state will provide our economic development needs, and also gets us into the sports family. So that's kind of a wishy-washy answer to your question.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Like, I think we should...
Here's this experience you need. It's 30 years down the line for you and kind of your document.
Well, you never know.
Well, thank you.
It's so important. Cancel those plans.
I just have a little bit more optimism.
I believe, even though it looks like a long shot at this point, but we need to start out someplace. If you don't plan out, it's not going to happen even 100 years. So this is a small step, but it could be, like a President Kennedy, he planned to go to the moon, and it was an idea, but we got there.
That's right.
The same thing could happen in our...
Right. If you don't start, you'll never get there.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close here. Please.
Oh, let's close that.
Okay, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 952, and then we will hear it again tomorrow. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. I note that we have Councillor Rod Monroe and Mike Britton-Vickers. And it's down on the schedule. I know they have to back to Portland. Are we going to move ahead or get them on?
We are going to move ahead. Only I need to know how many people signed up to testify. I'd like to 13.
Double good luck?
Yes. Mr. Chair, while we're waiting for them to come up, the one suggestion I would make regarding the Olympics bill,
yes.
952, is that Mr. McArdle noted several times that we might want to look at international games in general.
Of course.
And not just the Olympics. And I wonder if maybe the, will the amendment cover a broader definition than just the Olympic Games?
Definitely, for sure.
Okay,
I think his suggestion is very good.
But have we drafted amendments to consider?
I don't think we did that. Did we draft it away, not just the Olympic Games? But
We'll have to make another request to legislate the word Olympic.
We have many other bills, but the members from the the Metro, a good, my good friend, is here to testify. They need to go back to 5 o'clock, so I think we will take at this time the public hearing on Senate Bill 1313. Okay, I'd like to also let the public hearing Senate Bill 1313. I would like to welcome the Mike Burton, the executive director from the Metro, and then John Chandler, and then Mike Mondo, the president. Yeah, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Lim, members of the committee. My name is Rod Monroe, and I am the presiding officer of the Metro Council. Appreciate this opportunity, and I certainly appreciate your courtesy in taking us early so that we can get back to a very important regional meeting that involves all of the 24 cities and 3 counties in important land use and transportation planning decisions. And that meeting starts at 5 o'clock at your headquarters.
And if I may add that the Mike and Rob both have been the House member some time ago. I think we served together at the same time, but the that Rod has been House member before I was born, I guess.
I served in the House for 4 years in the 70s and for 8 years in the Senate during the 80s.
Thank you.
And when Mr. Burton was a state representative.
Thank you.
And so we have worked together before, and now we're working together again to try and make Metro the best regional government possible.
Thank you.
As you may know, Metro is a regional government with a home rule charter. It has an elected executive officer, Mr. Burton. It has an auditor. They're both elected region-wide. And it has a 7-member council, and I am one of those 7 members. I'm also a former legislator, so I understand that it's necessary to be brief in these remarks, so I will be brief. The voters of the Metro region approved the Metro Home Rule Charter in 1992, after having created Metro in a public vote in 1978. Being on the front lines for growth and transportation planning is not an easy place to be. However, we work hard to coordinate with 24 cities and 3 counties to get a sensible, workable growth plan that will accommodate the estimated 500,000 additional people who will live in the metropolitan region within the next 20 years. The dissolution of Metro will effectively do away with a unified regional urban growth boundary. We pride ourselves on keeping communities livable, creating economic opportunity, and providing first-rate recreation and convention facilities to our citizens. We would respectfully request that you do not void the voices of the voters of our region who approved the Home Rule Charter just 7 years ago. Metro has a proven track record of taking facilities that were losing money and in disrepair and are making them viable and successful. We've been given facilities by both the City of Portland and Multnomah County and are operating the Oregon Convention Center, the Expo, the Oregon Zoo, and regional parks. We work with our regional partners to provide a growth plan that will benefit the region as a whole, and I might add that follows state law that you passed in 1995 requiring us to have a 20-year land supply. Now, we've lowered the fees for our transfer stations twice over the past 18 months and have reached a solid waste agreement that will force rates to be at market value, and that new agreement will take effect next January. I would ask this committee to vote no on this Senate bill. I'm always available to discuss issues of concern. I want to take a moment to thank Senator Lim for carrying Senate Bill 1031 regarding minor boundary changes that's body passed a week ago. He's also carried another important piece of legislation for Metro. Those measures that Senator Lim carried and that passed successfully will be of little value, however, if the agency ceases to exist. This legislation is going to assist us. We have some other pieces of legislation. We want to work with you and the state government to improve the entire state and especially to do things that are necessary to the preservation of quality of life, economic viability for half the state's population that lives within the Metro District. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Lim, members of the committee. And my name is Mike Burton. I'm the executive officer of Metro, and I appreciate also the opportunity to have an opportunity to discuss with you as members of the legislature, or anyone for that matter, about what Metro's role is, often a misunderstood government. And so, Senator Lim, I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill and to discuss that. And as Rory mentioned, someone who spent 10 years in the Oregon legislature, I think Senator Fisher, Senator Gordley, and I served during the same session in the House side. Senator Duncan was, at that time, the superintendent of instruction, so I feel like I'm amongst friends. Tony and I have known each other for a number of years, as you and I have.
You were right in front of me.
You certainly were. You got the lunch before I did, Senator. You always got the lunch before I do. You always sit close to the door in order to make the lunch break.
I think too much sugar hard can beat us all.
Yeah, he's the one in January. He was left early, though. Anyway, now as the elected executive officer of Metro, and I should point out that my constituency is after the statewide elected offices in Oregon is the largest constituency in Oregon, about 1.5 million people that live in the metropolitan area. I have a new appreciation for working on these issues on the ground and the job that I have. Metro, as Rod mentioned, is a home rule charter mandated responsibility to plan for growth in the region. We've faced explosive growth in the past decade. In our particular area. Decisions about growth management, how to provide a working transportation system, how to conserve land, air, and water for future generations, and how we want our communities to look and feel do not come easily and are by definition controversial. But the reason the region works, the reason we are successful, I believe, in protecting our quality of life is that somebody has to make the tough decisions in planning for growth. Metro has that job in the Portland metropolitan area, and we are accountable to the public. Metro is accountable because it is directly elected. With a 7-person elected council, elected by districts, and a regionally elected executive officer and auditor. We are elected to make the tough decisions about growth management in Portland metropolitan area. Metro's role is crucial in the region. The urban portions of Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties are the home to 52% of the state's population. The relatively small geographic area, just 362 square miles, shares a common economy, a common labor pool, including jobs for 55,000 Oregon income tax-paying Washingtonians. We have common watersheds, common airsheds, and a common transportation system that supplies the rest of the state of Oregon with wings, wheels, and waterways to markets throughout the United States and the rest of the world. Coordination and cooperation is crucial to the economic and environmental vitality of the region. The voters of the region have approved 7 of 9 measures Metro has put before them, including approving the Home Rule Charter in 1982. The bulk of our $400 million budget is due to voter-approved measures, including recently a $135 million open space measure, a $35 million capital improvement at the Oregon Zoo, and measures to build the original Oregon Convention Center. Metro is a streamlined organization that has emphasized efficiency, enterprise efforts, and privatization. Metro has no property tax-based general fund. Only the Oregon Zoo has a property tax operating fund, which was approved by the voters of the region in 1990. All other activities at Metro are enterprise-based. Our general fund derived from small excise tax on those enterprise activities. By combining support services for the Convention Center, Expo Center, the Oregon Zoo, Performing Arts Center, Civic Stadium, regional parks, including Oxbow and Blue Lake, and solid waste operations, we create an efficiency in accounting, legal, and personnel services, as well as providing remarkably inexpensive risk management costs to all Metro departments and divisions. Dispersing these activities to different government agencies, as the bill proposes, would only increase the support services costs for each entity and, by extension, the public costs to the public. Further, our contracted license passport program offers one-stop shopping for small businesses in the region. And again, Senator Lim, I want to thank you for carrying that bill, which increased the ceiling on that for contractors, which is requested in this session. We successfully managed the disposal of the region's solid waste by consistently reducing tipping fees while increasing recycling rates in the region. Our Data Resource Center is a national model for geographic information systems and has won international recognition as well. And I might add here, dealing with multiple boundaries, as we have, as you can imagine, with the 24 cities and the three counties, there's often a lot of debates over boundaries. We have been given that responsibility for ameliorating those issues. And again, Senator Lamb, I want to add my thanks to you for carrying the bill to straighten that matter out recently. Senate Bill 1313, I think, would threaten the innovative and efficient efforts to manage growth, protect farm and forest land, and save taxpayers' money by streamlining government services. And I would urge you to vote no on it tonight.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the member?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Fisher.
Mike, you don't happen to have any good pictures of office buildings that I can use for station, do you?
Senator Lim, Senator Fisher, I've probably typed up something. I remember that.
I won't elaborate on that.
No, I just ended it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, okay. I do have a
question.
Thank you very much. Excuse me. First of all, I appreciate the testimony of both gentlemen, and I do recall with a great deal of pride having served with former Representative Burton. You were one of the folks that I watched closely and carefully when I came into the legislature in 1991. I learned a great deal from you. And it's a pleasure to see you this afternoon and in this role. The concern I have, you both have stated very clearly your opposition to the bill, but could you also speak more directly, definitively about what would be lost to the region if Metro were to be dissolved as we know it?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I could probably spend quite a bit of time on this one. I'll try to summarize some things. It's often been said that Metro and the Portland Metro is unique, one of a kind, the only type of government of its sort in the United States. Actually, that's not at all accurate. There are hundreds, thousands of multi-jurisdictional, multi-purpose governments in the United States. In the Portland metropolitan area, the Port of Portland, the TriMet, the Council of Governments in the Willamette Valley and the Umpqua Valley, and Lane County governments, they're all multi-jurisdiction, often multiple-purpose governments that have different roles. Yeah, throughout the United States, there are over 350 regional governments that have similar functions that our metropolitan government does. What is different about us is that we're directly elected, and I think that makes us more accountable. Specifically, if you were to take away this activity, if Metro as a government didn't exist, first of all, there's a federal requirement to have a metropolitan planning organization. The federal government in the 1960s, when they created the interstate system, which was the National Defense Road System, went to the states and said, we don't want to deal with multiple jurisdictions as we plan this system and allocate dollars to it. So come up with some system to create a planning organization that will both fiscal those dollars and make those decisions. So in the absence of Metro doing that, you'd have to create another entity to do that. In fact, the meeting that Presenting Officer Monroe and I are going to at 5 o'clock is a meeting of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee and the Metropolitan Planning Advisory Committee, which has the mayors and city councilors and commissioners from those jurisdictions who sit down together in a rather laborious process and hammer out trying to spend the $75 million in the federal SCIP money that comes to the region against at least $330 million worth of needs that we could identify as high priority needs. We process, formulate that, we staff that function, and we get those decisions made. In the absence of that, you'd have to recreate that, recreate another government to deal with it under the federal rules. Secondly, as I mentioned, if you begin to disperse the services that we have, the convention center, the zoo, the expo center, the parks that we operate, regional parks, those, the economic efficiency you gain by having centralized data services, accounting services, and those types of things, would be dispersed out. You lose an economy of scale in the operation of those kinds of things. In land use and in solid waste, in the solid waste system, you'd have to have 24 cities trying to find a franchise to operate transfer stations somewhere. We operate 200 metropolitan area. You'd have to create those transfer stations or come up with some sort of an agreement and create a solid waste authority to do that. So you'd have to duplicate that solid waste system. In land use planning, as you may know, we had a common urban growth boundary around the 24 cities in the 3-county area. It's probably the most difficult thing we'd have to deal with in the sense of the public's attitude about these things, because Oregonians, as you know, hate two things. They hate sprawl and they hate density. And that's what we're about. We're trying to find somewhere to sort of make sense of all of that around those entities where in Clackamas County, every morning about 65% of the people who go to work in Clackamas County and Senator Duncan's area down there get up and go to work outside of the county because it's job starved. We're trying to work out so we get a jobs and housing balance. On the other hand, in Washington County, 70% of the people in Washington County get up and want to go to work, stay in Washington County. But there's a huge transference population across those regions. To have a coordinated transportation plan along with the huge need we have to create a freight program to keep freight moving through that. At any given day, in any given hour, there are $14 million worth of goods on wheels in the metropolitan area, moving in the area. That doesn't include rail or shipping. That is on trucks. So we have a huge effort there to try to coordinate those efforts with our land use. In the absence of Metro formulating those planning efforts, trying to work with the port, those various jurisdictions, the private industries that need to move those goods, the private industries that are creating jobs in the area, and understanding their need to create jobs and have goods move, you'd break it into 24 parts or 27 parts. And you'd lose the coordinating efforts that go on. The decisions that the council has to make about these things in coordination with their local governments are not easy ones. You come into those meetings and it's like a good knockdown, drag out family squabble, but everybody knows in the final analysis that everybody's ultimately trying to reach a common goal. And we provide that mechanism to facilitate those goals and to choose the decision that we're going to need.
The level of regional cooperation and coordination in the Portland area is unprecedented. I've traveled all across this country. I've talked to government officials from other urban regions, and they wonder how you do it. How do you get people from Hillsborough and Gresham and Wilsonville and Portland who all agree on how scarce federal transportation dollars ought to be spent? How do you get them to all agree on how much the urban boundary ought to be expanded and where? The level of regional cooperation and coordination is unprecedented, and I believe that's because we have this elected regional entity called Metro. Please preserve it.
Okay. I know the time is running out. That's the $400 million for this budget. Could you give me 1 minute where that money is coming from mostly?
Mostly from voter-approved levies. So we've gone out $135 million of that in the year that was $400 million, less than that now. In the year that was $400 million, was $135 million of that was a voter-approved open spaces measure with which we have, in fact, a goal was to get 6,000 acres of land. We have reached about 70% of that with the expenditure of less than half of that money, so we may be able to do more than that. Of that was a voter-approved bond measure to expand the Oregon Zoo. And if you go up, that's being done in phases. We've completed the first part of that. The bulk of the dollars there, convention center dollars, are voter-approved measures. Metro's operating tax base at the zoo is about $7 million a year. That's all. The rest of those dollars are enterprise money that move through the system from solid waste funds that we pass on to pay for the transference of the region's million tons of garbage a year out to Arlington. In fact, we're collectively, even though we don't directly employ anyone out there, we provide most of the employment in Gillum County through the transfer station or the solid waste station landfill out there and the transfer costs. So most of the money actually is dollars that are transferred from fees that are collected on solid waste and then passed on for the disposal of that, about $168 million. Dollars that break down from interest and from transfer monies and set aside, for example, we have to maintain about a $7 to $10 million reserve fund for the St. John's landfill, which we inherited from the city of Portland. And that landfill, part of it was 50 years old. The environmental responsibility we have for that is probably going to be with us for the next 50 to 60 to 70 years. In fact, I get concerned about it because it's out in my district, and the portion that was filled in the most recent years is probably solid, but some of that is going into the slough, creates a problem there, so we're working to clean that up. So we have those kind of reserve funds as well. When you get down to the actual operating funds for the government itself, for the non-enterprise activities, it's a very small percentage of the total budget we've got. And actually, I have a chart. I think we've got enough for everyone here that shows exactly where the revenues come from.
Lim, we provided that to you last week, but we have copies for all members of the committee. If you want to take a look at it in terms of the current revenues are $172 million, you say, well, what's the $400 million? That's because current revenues are different than the bonds. And you can see the convention fund bond debt there is $5.6 million remaining on that. The zoo tax base is $6.5 million. The debt for the bonds at the zoo, which is the expansion portion on the single levy, is $2.4 million. And the open spaces bonds is $11 million. And those, of course, are being used to buy land. So about 58-59% of our revenues are enterprise. 14% are off of real estate taxes. Those are voter-approved bonds. We have intergovernmental revenues of 15.9%, interest earnings of 6%, and other revenues of about 4.8%. So you can see that it's a uniquely funded. And by the way, the funds are firewalled. You cannot use solid waste funds for anything that's solid waste. You can't use the zoo operating funds for anything the zoo and so on and so forth, which is different also from governments that have a general fund base. I would argue this is a pretty good model for most governments if they follow the same funding model.
Only I'm talking about the big if it's going to be passed from the House and Senate, then it must be a constitutional change. Is it going to the metro area or is it statewide to dissolve this metro?
Well,
isn't only the metro created by the metropolitan an area?
Yeah.
With the people. So how is it going to the statewide, I guess?
Chair, I hope we didn't get to that point, but if this measure went out, I suppose it depends on how the bill would be designed. But the Constitution provision allows the creation of a Metropolitan Service District as a charter, home rule charter, is in the Constitution. You'd have to remove that provision from the Constitution. It seems to me like there's two steps. One would be to remove that provision from the Constitution that would disallow any local community to set up home rule charter metropolitan districts or river districts if they wanted to do that. And then secondly, if that was disallowed, then you'd have to go back into that. And I would argue that the debate should be made in the region itself. I've spoken around the state. I don't believe that the folks in Medford or LeGrand are any interested in how we do our government any more than they want us to get their nose into their business. I think that's one of the things we got to do. We got to just sort of let folks do in their own region. So hopefully the vote, if there's anyone taking, be taken in that far area.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just an additional comment for the information of the committee and also Mr. Burton and Mr. Monroe. We have a letter from Mike Thorne. Mike Thorne is Executive Director of the Port of Portland, as you all know, and the Port of Portland is a part of my district. And Mr. Thorne indicates that, and I'm going to summarize the letter, he's writing to express the Port of Portland's support for continuation of a Portland metropolitan regional government to facilitate orderly, consistent approaches to transportation planning, transportation funding allocation, land use planning and growth management, waste management, and parks and green spaces. And to continue on briefly, he says that the court does not always concur with the approaches Metro takes to these issues, but we do not support dissolution as proposed in Senate Bill 1313. The economic and livability issues with which the Tri-County area must grapple as it grows cannot be effectively managed in isolation, city by city, or even county by county. And the members can certainly read the rest of the letter, but I did want to say this on the record.
Okay, since the members need to go back to the meeting at 5 o'clock, but I would allow one question from Senator Cochran.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say to Ms. Monroe and Mr. Burton, welcome to the club. The people that are attacking you now are the same people that have run a coordinated attack against public employees and public entities, you know, and are destroying the state, destroying people's confidence in the state. And I really want to welcome you to a very, you know, tough club to have to deal with, but I sure hope you guys prevail. And I live down in Cottage Grove, and it isn't any of my damn business how you run the show up there. So keep up the good work.
Sure. I appreciate all those comments. I do want to say that, again, I think it's valuable for us to have ourselves questions sometimes. It's useful to be able to have an exchange like this one. I appreciate that. I think that a lot of the times, and maybe it's just the folks haven't really got a sense of what we do, and we're really happy to come out and explain that. We are a little different in that, but I think it works in the metropolitan area, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer.
So you were going to say
wanted to kind of capitalize on your remarks about the rest of the state getting a piece of the action, something that was really in their backyard, and I would kind of ask you guys to take it back and use the influence that you can to let them know that a few things that happen in our backyard that's got four legs and long tails and big teeth, and some of those issues we kind of feel the same way about, and probably maybe a little bit of this is comes from a feeling that once in a while we get the back end of about 52% of the population is in a very, very small geographical area of the state.
Well, and Senator Fisher, I really appreciate someone who grew up on a dairy farm. I understand that sometimes that there's a lack of understanding across the urban and rural areas. Both Mr. Monroe and I have spoken out quite often about getting a greater understanding between the issues that are facing rural areas and how we're dealing with those in urban areas. The listing of the fish, for example, in the metropolitan area has been a good wake-up call for a lot of our folks to recognize the imprint that an urban area makes on the ecology, how we can be perhaps far more destructive sometimes in that we need to be sensitive to each other. So we have a need to work together and to be as sensitive to each other's needs as possible, and I do appreciate that.
Thank you. I appreciate you. You know, one of the things I'd like to mention, that even with the metro issue, that it is not strictly metro, so it's just a light rail issue. I consider it a metro issue, north and south light rail, but it's voted by the statewide, and it went down. And so things happen.
But, Senator Lem, we're not trying that. Not that we don't do a lot of good coordination with them and support those activities. I, without speculating on that last vote, generally in the metropolitan area, the light rail has been supported. I think, again, that last vote might have been a misunderstanding. There was some sense, I think, that somehow, and that's a feeling that we all have to come to grips with, is that Portland somehow sucks all the money out of the rest of the state. And really, that isn't the case. In fact, that light rail measure would have had some of the money that would have come to the metropolitan area go downstate. It was just not understood, and I think we did a bad job on our end of it explaining that part of it to the rest of the state. And it was a good case of our needing to get up out of town and go down to the other folks and find out how they felt about things. So that's a good role for us to play.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming out this time. We do appreciate it, and hope to see you again.
Chair, light rail will be successful when gas goes up to $2.50 a gallon, believe me.
And yet, that's part of the incentive, I guess. John Chapman, OBIA. Is it OBIA? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on Senate Bill 1313 in opposition. I come before you, I wanted to specify because I thought it would be important for you to hear from one of the regulated entities that Metro has a great deal of involvement with. We haven't always liked Metro. We haven't always agreed with Metro. We've sued them off and on several times over the years. We've had knockdown, dragouts, headbutts over all sorts of issues, and we very likely will continue to, but we support their continued existence.
Mr. Chair, that shows in both John's and Mike's head.
All right.
That's a bowling ball joke.
It is an imperfect entity, as is any city council, school board, or legislature.
Oh, I see, man. I don't know what you're talking about.
Metro, not my head.
Yes.
Yeah. Burton's head I will not speak to.
I see the way
that's going to be done. I know. I'll put these in writing later. I think there's an important discussion to have about how much Metro functions. I think some of the questions you asked were good ones. I think it's also important, though, to realize, as Senator Corcoran pointed out, this is a Metro area issue. And it was a Metro charter that was adopted by the region's voters. And it's that region that has to live with the good things or bad things that Metro manages to pull off. I do a lot of traveling around the country as well, speaking on land use issues of various groups. And what we're doing in Portland, or trying to do in Portland, I think it's important to categorize it as a work in progress, is being looked at elsewhere as a model. Now, sometimes that may be a good thing, it may not be, but I think it's something that should be encouraged, watched perhaps, critiqued perhaps, but encouraged as an experiment in how to get diverse groups, cities, counties, special interests, citizens, under one roof to talk about issues that affect all of them. Our current geographic political boundaries, cities and counties, are somewhat historical anachronisms in the first place. Going into the next century and looking at how we structure our political life, I think, in my opinion, probably more regional thinking rather than less is more appropriate. We're dealing with watersheds now under the famine issue. That's going to require regional thinking. We're dealing with transportation issues and recognizing that what one city does, whether it be through annexation voting or through job creation, affects cities down the road. And having to be able to think outside of those political boundaries that were arbitrarily designed in the first place is going to be essential to making our state function. And, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good discussion to have. We would encourage the committee to not move this bill. I'd be glad to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. None. Thank you very much. Okay, and since even though time is limited, I'd like to give opportunity. Anyone like to testify on Senate Bill 1313? If not, we will close the public hearing 1313. Okay, and then I'd like to open a public hearing on, at this time, Senate Bill 950.
Public hearing.
Yes, public hearing and possible work session. We looked at this issue before.
Yes.
We changed the language it should be missing there. 950. Okay, I just want to give opportunity. Anyone like to testify on Senate Bill 950? I don't believe so. Then I'm going to close the public hearing Senate Bill 950 and open Senate Bill work session 950. Okay, so Kevin, could you explain to me what the 950 does, at least the memory is?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You had a public hearing on this bill last week. It designates the month of May each year as Asian American Heritage Month. It requires the Commission on Asian Affairs to coordinate statewide celebrations of Asian American Heritage Month. It encourages the State Board of Education to develop curriculum regarding this month. And the bill, 950, required school districts to designate time for instruction and activities in commemoration of the Asian Americans. Senator Duncan questioned that and felt that it would be more appropriate to allow school discretion to designate time rather than to require it. And so the proposed amendment that you have in front of you is a very simple one. It simply changes the word shall in line 15 to the word may. I spoke to the Board of School Districts, who assured me that they had no opposition to the bill so long as that word was changed.
I move the dash one amendment, Mr.
Chair. Okay. Senator Duncan moves the dash one amendment. Any objections? Senator Abbott.
Chair, I move 950 as amended to the floor with a 2-3 recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves the Senate 950 to the floor with a 2-3 recommendation as amended. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gordon.
I look forward to casting an aye vote and would just like to share that there is another bill moving in the Ways and Means process, that Senate Bill 103, which would require the State Department of Education to implement a multicultural curriculum and also put in place a multicultural curriculum policy. And so I believe that some of the issues you wish to address through the department and through curriculum will in fact be addressed through this other bill.
Okay.
And its prospects for movement out of Ways and Means look good at this point.
Okay. Any other comments? If not, are we ready to move? Oh yes. Let's just call the
Senator
Cochran? Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Fisher? Senator
Gordley? Aye. Senator Murray? Aye. The Senate Bill 950 passed. As amended. And then any volunteers to tell this bill? Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chair, I'd rather not, because I have a little problem. I generally don't like the idea of the Legislative Assembly writing curriculum. I'm going to support the bill.
Okay.
Rather not to.
So, any other volunteers?
Yeah, the character for me to.
Yes, the Senator Cochran didn't carry. Okay. Thank you. Well, appreciate it.
I may change it to Irish Heritage Month, but it's not my ask. Or Chinese Irish Heritage Month.
Okay. And what's the next one that we have to make more? It will take some time. Okay. I'd like to close work session. Did I close that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to make sure. I'd like to close the work session. Can I feel 950? Is it 950? Yes, 950. Okay, and then I'd like to open a public hearing, Senate Bill 861. Is there any person like to testify on Senate Bill 861 at this time? Okay, before that, we have some amendments. We will read that and we'll invite you in here. Okay, and to give us what the 861 does and what are the amendments.
Okay, Senate Bill 861 removed the authority of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to sell distilled liquor in sealed containers, and it went through the various provisions that would be removed from the statute in order to effect that change, and that portion, that bill would be effective on January 1st in the year 2000. The amendment, however, the -2 amendment, is the amendment you have before you. It replaces the bill with the language of the amendment. So if you look at the amendment, you're looking at the bill. And what the amendment does is make one requirement of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and that is that of the 5 persons who are appointed by the governor, at least one and no more than 2 members shall come from the food and retail beverage and beverage retail industry. So the amendments make a very minor change to the law.
What's the amendment that is it -1?
-2 amendment. Yes.
So what it does, exactly the same thing, only as allow up to 2.
Yes. The Oregon Liquor Commission is not changed.
Okay.
Only that 2 members may be appointed from the industry, and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission's authority to sell distilled liquor is not changed in any way.
Okay. So this is completely replaced.
Completely replaced. Yes.
Okay. So, would you like to testify? This is a completely new deal. Okay. Please come.
Okay.
And then, what is your name? I don't have your name. What?
Lynn McNamara.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Lynn, members of the committee. I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. We didn't have an opinion on the original bill, but we do on the amendments. We're not sure what the impetus is for this change, but we don't particularly see it as necessary. The commission, we think, as it stands, works very well. It does have a member from the industry. This is a regulatory agency. It is overseeing the industry that sells alcohol. And my own experience in attending commission meetings, the commissioners seem to understand the industry and all of the issues very well. It does not appear to me, at least, that any additional industry members are needed for the commission to understand its role in regulating and upholding the laws of the state. And we really don't see any reason for this change.
Okay. You know this bill is not required.
Yes, I am.
It's just allowing. It's up to the governor to appoint if it's needed to be. It could be one person. So it's simply that the mechanism to allow. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Duncan.
Wait, what you just said, that is the bill, one member must be.
No? Wait.
This is
one member must be there for the court on the statute. Out of five members. That's a current.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. It's Ms. McNamara. Good afternoon to you. Does your organization, has there been discussion about this measure having the impact of possibly increasing opportunities to sell alcohol, or that there might be increased sales and increased access as well as sales?
Senator Lynn, Senator Gordley, we haven't had that particular discussion, but cities have tried to work closely with the commission, and that has been an evolving relationship, as I understand it, and has really kind of come into its own in the recent past. Cities share the commission's perception of their desire to uphold the laws and to make sure that they are working well, and the cities and the commission work well together. It's more on that basis that we're concerned about changing the balance. We have something that works, and we don't see a need to change it right now.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes. Yeah.
Perhaps somebody could define the word bailment for me. I'm not familiar with that term, bailment contract.
Are you looking at the same deal?
The bill has been replaced, Senator Fisher. With the amendments, they totally replaced the bill.
Okay.
And they make a very minimum change to the law. And that is that instead of a single member who shall be of the commission, he shall be from the food and retail beverage, food and alcohol beverage industry. It increases it that there may be two members from that industry, not mandatory, but discretionary to the governor. And that is the only effect of the amendment.
This is a complete replacement.
Replacement.
I had a similar question, Mr. Chair, because I was also relying on the staff measure summary for information.
Is the staff summary of course at this time?
Well, the staff summary, what the bill does,
it refers to the amendment.
The original bill. And then you have to look at the effect of treaty amendments to understand what the amendments are.
All right.
So when the bill is changed to an amended version, then what the bill does will change to reflect the amendment.
Okay.
Very confusing.
Yes.
Thing.
At this time, I'm wondering, could you give us your wisdom on this one? I'm sure you heard our testimony that some of the discussions we have.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Katie Koba, and I serve as the Executive Appointments Director in the Governor's Office. Obviously, I just found out about this proposed amendment sitting in the back of the room. I would say, generally, we tend to prefer more broad authority for the governor in terms of appointments as opposed to specifying who serves on boards and commissions. I would say that without this change to the statute, the governor can, we currently have one member from the industry that serves on the commission. He could certainly choose to appoint more than one member now.
Right now?
Yes, given the statute. Well, unless it says no more than one member.
I think it's only one member at the current statute.
Okay.
This will allow up to two.
Okay.
It's the governor's choice, yeah.
I would probably say in general he would have concerns about putting additional industry members on the commission that regulates the industry. He would probably tend to look more broadly at community leaders, which is typically what we look at to serve on boards and commissions, and not someone that comes with a certain perspective to serve on a board or a commission.
Which means that the governor doesn't have to appoint.
That's correct.
Only just allowing that his choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I think they have plenty of input. They have lobbyists, and I'm going back to my days working with the Board of Education. We never had somebody. There was never anybody from the K-12 serving on the board. You kept us very separate, and I'm inclined to believe you should keep them separate.
Even the building industry, I don't know how many they are, maybe more than 10 members. I understand 7 or 8 members coming from the building industry.
I don't think that's
exactly. Yes, corporate.
No, it does. Well, no, actually, I'm looking at one.
All others, it is, that's nothing changes. It's the current statute. The only big letters, that's the that's a change only.
Okay. I actually was looking at the ones, and in looking at the two,
yes,
you are correct. It doesn't require
no
two members. It says at least one, but I agree with just Senator Duncan. I don't think you want starting to hand out. I think you want the governor to be able to put his own imprint or her own imprint on, what kind of people that they want. And if you include two, then you may do it at the exclusion of, somebody who's a professional in a totally different area that would be a very important member of the commission. So I'm not quite sure that I don't think I would support changing it.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
A question for Ms. Koba. In the history of the commission, has there always been at least one member from the industry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, with this commission, since I've been working for the governor, that is the case. I share with you, for example, the Lottery Commission, which does not have an industry representative on it. We've had industry folks try to get an industry representative slot on the Lottery Commission. That's not been something that we've been excited about. Another situation, we have the Board of Higher Ed, where last session a bill went through that allowed the governor to appoint a faculty member. Again, it was not required. It was his choice. And now, of course, we have those supporting the faculty consistent in their request that we fill that slot with a faculty member. So even though it's not mandatory, I can just anticipate who will be knocking at my door at the next opening on the OLCC commission, requesting that an industry person be placed on the commission.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Fisher.
I think some of the advisory committees too do not have members of the professions on. I can think of one, I believe the long-term care ombudsman advisory initiative or committee does not have a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, off the top of my head, I couldn't say for sure. We've got over 200 boards and commissions obviously you have licensing boards where it is the industry folks licensing themselves.
Right.
But there's a variety of boards and commissions.
It seems that as it could be that letter of intoxication and such as a trade issue. It seems to me someone hopefully doesn't know anything about trade, they are in their board and commissions, you know, they decide. And this industry, you know, I'm not saying they don't know, but they might not know exactly what is going on, and those people deciding for the industry. And so that at least that one or two people might balance out, and it is not such a principle, you know, it is not the situation regarding the chickens. Of course, I think I clearly understand that intention. Sometimes some industries maybe might not best, but this case is, this is not allowing, just giving them some opportunity. If up to the government to make that decision, you know, I don't see any why such that, you know, the opinion is different. It is not mandatory.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Okay, anyway, that's a use case of opinion, but I respect that. Thank you. And I'd like to hear from the Barbara Hutchinson on this issue. Welcome again.
Thank you.
And is that your opinion on
the case? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barb Hutchinson from the Liquor Commission. The commissioners have not come together to cast any formal opinion or position on the Dash 2 amendments. But I did have a staff person do a little history piece for me that I thought I might be able to share, and I think it answers some of the questions that Senator Duncan and Senator Gordley had as well. First of all, the Knox Act, which created the commission, said, and this is a quote, this is back in 1933, the administration of the law pertaining to the traffic in alcoholic beverages should be divorced as far as possible from all elements of personal, partisan, or local politics. You did ask the question as to whether or not we had always had a member from the retail beverage industry on the commission. The answer is no. Until 1979, there were three members chosen from the public by the governor. In that year, the three-member board went to a five-member board, and one of those five people was designated as an industry rep. The other four were to come from the other four congressional districts. Again, there was an amendment to the bill that created the Liquor Commission in 1987, and it specifically said that any person with a financial interest in any licensed business or a manufacturer should not hold office of a commissioner other than the designated one commissioner, and potential conflicts of interest should be prohibited. The feeling was, I think, that keeping interest groups off the board and off staff has been a very integral part of the whole control state philosophy that Oregon adopted in 1933.
What was that phrase again, Mr. Chair, about other than the designated?
It was amended to specify that any person with a financial interest in a licensed business or a manufacturer should not hold office of a commissioner other than the single designated commissioner.
Single designated by whom?
By the governor, the industry representative. We have found that the current commission works quite well. I have asked staff to kind of go back in history, and they say that there have been unanimity between the industry people and the non-industry people, that they it works very well. They bring a broad perspective. I think that the idea is that for a citizens' commission like this, that the broader and deeper the mix is, the more objective the board can be in making decisions. All industry groups or all interest groups have a number of opportunities to participate in commission decision making. We have task groups, we have advisory groups, we have rulemaking advisory groups, And we have at our monthly commission meetings an opportunity for the public to come forward anytime and talk. I think the current commissioners have a fear that adding or possibly even talking about the possibility of adding another industry person will give the public the perception that the industry is establishing public policy that's possibly self-motivated and self-serving. I've only been at the commission about 4 years, but I know that just in the last couple of years, I think we've made inroads into helping people understand that we are not, in bed with the industry, that we give all people an opportunity to participate in decisions. And we're really pleased to have industry work with us as well as they do. It might be a move towards establishing a self-regulating body for the alcohol industry.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, interesting observation. It allows three of the commissioners to be of the same political party, and it decries having any political influence. I don't know why we couldn't have had a communist or two on here to even things up a bit. Or perhaps an independent, it would seem like if they want to really avoid that, they would also avoid having a majority of one political party on the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, with a five-member committee, I think they're just saying that they don't want to have more than three of any one political party so that it doesn't become overbalanced on one side or the other.
Well, three is overbalanced on a five-member committee.
You see the headline tomorrow. Fisher Post, Communist Post.
That means there's room for independence.
There's certainly room for independence, but I think actually the makeup right now may be wrong. I think we have three Republicans and two Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it should be three Democrats and three Republicans. No? Okay. Anyway, thank you very much.
You.
Is there any other person like to testify on Senate Bill 950? H61. If not, we'll... Yes.
Before you do the gavel, I would just like to share my own comment. I appreciate the last witness's comments about perception, because that's really where I'm focused this afternoon. I think that this is a peculiar business that the state is in the first place, and that is selling alcohol to make money. That's what we do. And I think we need a commission that is perception being everything, that we need a commission that is perceived to be as well as is as independent as possible. So that's the concern that I have about the issue in front of us.
Okay. With that, any other comment like to make from the members? If not, we'll close the public hearing page 61. And we are going to put that clip for a while. Okay. Let me see. Maybe we can go back in the
We have a machine for code. I'm going to have to be using my officer down in the NAD.
Okay.
So I'll,
okay. If the members bear with me, I'd like to open the public hearing on 11:46 at this time.
Okay. Okay, how long?
Okay, Carol, why don't you give us the little glimpse of the 11:46?
This, Mr. Chair and members, is a bill that you also have already had at one public hearing, and it allows health care facilities to be included as an eligible business firm under the Enterprise Zone program. There are -1 amendments for your consideration today, and they describe these amendments that you also saw previously. They describe a remote rural health service area and allow health care facilities only in remote rural health service areas. And they also make a special provision that would allow for the dialysis center in Astoria to be considered for eligibility under the Enterprise Zone program.
Okay. That's it?
Yes.
Okay, as you may remember, last time, as a Senator Duke, one of the sponsors opposed this bill, especially via Section 6. At this moment, she is staying on neutral, not opposing it, and that's why we bring this back. I didn't thought that the Senator from the district opposed it. I thought I was not going to bring it back, since it's staying on neutral. And bring it back for consideration passage from this committee. And let me see, is there any person like to testify on Senate 1146 in here? Okay, please. Okay. Come on, give us your last comment on this bill.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Fish is coming forward.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Carol.
Yes.
Do we know if Representative Taylor is in support or is neutral on the bill? Could we find that out as well?
Certainly can.
And if, when it goes to the House,
mm-hmm.
they are going to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, let's keep the time right, let's move it out as possible. So let's go to the House and find out. Okay. And could you give your opinion on this 1146 at this time? Is that 1146? No. Okay. Do you have, this is the same thing that we looked at last time. Is that, to your opinion, is it in good or good order?
Chairman Lim, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic Development Department, and thank you for asking me to come up and provide you with whatever comments you'd like or questions to be answered. As far as Senate Bill 1146, I just as briefly as I can just say, you know, it would provide for health care as an eligible activity, which is currently not allowed in enterprise zones, along with retail and other types of ineligible activities. It would, in a way that I think the department feels is a much better approach, limit that to more remote rural areas that are maybe at a disadvantage from a community, community amenities perspective, from having medical facilities because they're distance, they don't have them, and people have to travel and so forth. And so I think that would be a far better way to proceed without opening this up too much, areas. And then lastly, the retroactivity is it's just kind of a technical thing in some ways to sort of capture, in particular, Dr. Parks. I can't think of any other example. I would actually say there probably is not another example. His property is not finished, so there's no exemption that anybody could have gotten beforehand. That would go back in time. All that's going back in time to do is deal with the fact that the zone is terminated and that, as it had to be, the application for pre-certification that was submitted on time was denied. And so it would recapture those elements and allow that property to qualify next year as it might have normally done had the zone been in effect a couple of years ago.
Okay. So it is, any application goes through the city and the whole thing, I guess, county.
The tax exemption?
Yes.
Yes, the tax exemption would be for 100% of the property value that would be otherwise added to the assessment rolls, and so that property will not be assessed and the taxes contributed to all the, almost, I guess, a dozen taxing districts, most of the city county school districts.
Any questions?
Going into work session on this?
Yes, please.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I want to make sure if any person like to testify in Senate 1146 at this time. If not, we'll close a public hearing in Senate 1146 and open the work session in Senate 1146. And I think I'd like to have a Senator Duncan in.
Mr. Chair, I would like to be careful since the conflict of interest in this particular issue. I don't have any intentions of ever doing something like this, but it might be construed because I am in the long-term care business that teacher. I might be looking out for myself in the future, and so I would want to keep that record that I am declaring a potential conflict of interest.
Thank you. That been noted in the book, in the record. And that we need to move dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 1146.
And the vote will be moved to say that the dash one amendment of the Senate Bill 1146. Any objection? Is adopted. Are we ready to work?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1146 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
And the vote will be moved to Senate Bill 1146 as amended that one to the floor with a two pass recommendation. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, as I recall from our previous hearing, we spent a lot of time talking about whether it's appropriate to extend this enterprise zone property tax exemption in this way. And one of the things that I am focusing on right now is what this does to increase access to health care, a particular type of health care in this particular instance. And so because it does something to expand access or increase access, as I understand it, I can vote in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Is there any discussion?
I'm in the same vote.
Thank you. Please call the roll.
Peter Corker.
Senator
Duncan?
Aye. Senator
Fisher?
Aye.
Senator
Fisher?
Aye. Senator 1146 has amended, it's passed. Senator Fisher, are you willing to carry this bill?
I suppose I can.
Okay, but we might have to declare the potential conflict. You will need to carry the bill, okay? That's all.
Fine with me.
Okay.
You desire.
Thank you. Yes, of course I do. Okay, with that, I'd like to close this work session on Senate 1146. And what do we have?
Yes. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would suggest that perhaps Senator Duke, since she is the chief sponsor, might wish to carry the bill.
I guess not. The chief of state will lose on this one.
Oh, okay. So,
but I would give a supporting speech at the same time.
All right.
Okay. And I think we might be able to do one more bill, which is Senate Bill 951. I'd like to open a public hearing, Senate Bill 951, and if you give us what is Senate Bill 951 does, what changes we have.
Mr. Chair, the original Senate Bill 951 made changes to the Commission on Asian Affairs. You have in front of you dash one amendments, which make further changes, and you should also have a handing growth version of the amended bill in front of you. This bill, as amended, goes much further in the changes, and in fact, it conforms the Commission on Asian Affairs more closely to the other advocacy commissions by removing the authority of the Commission to Promote Trade, Tourism, to develop programs relating to trade and tourism, and to serve as state representatives for foreign markets. It clarifies the mission of the commission to work for equality in Asian markets in Oregon, for Asian Americans in Oregon. It also removes the requirement for a member of the Commission on Asian Affairs to serve on the International Trade Commission, and it provides for two additional non-voting members to the Asian Commission on Asian Affairs, one from each of the legislative bodies, and each one to be appointed by the leader in that body. These are ex officio members. They have no voting rights.
Okay. Is it very easy to explain that we have some 3 years?
Oh, yes. You're absolutely correct. The term is increased from 2 to 3 years.
Okay. And with that, I'd like to call the Katie. I'd like to welcome you again here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Koba, serve as the Governor's Executive Appointments Director, and I'm here to support the Hanlon Gross Amendment to Senate Bill 951 that you find in front of you. we are supportive of the idea of aligning the Commission on Asian Affairs with the three other advocacy commissions that we have here in the state, those being the Commission on Black Affairs, Commission on Hispanic Affairs, and Commission for Women, and feel that the changes as outlined in the Hammond Gross Amendments would do that.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
What are the Hammond Gross Amendments that are being referred to here? I have two. I think two different.
Can I explain that for you?
Either one of the...
It's confusing.
The one that is marked on the top, in Gross Paragraph 428, that is the correct one.
Well, 428, right?
Yeah.
Which amendment does...
It's that one. The first one was the one that was sent to the Legislative Council for making the amendment, and it was just a work copy.
And this dash one is the one of the congressional districts?
It is the Legislative Council, yes. The one that was prepared by the Legislative Council.
This one
is here. No, this one is not.
That's called the dash one?
Then, I'm sorry, then I put the wrong dash number.
Dash two?
Look like a dash two here.
Behind the dash one. All right, then it's the dash two.
It's the only one.
Yes, that is it. It's the dash
two. Okay, the dash two amendment to
8238. And the dash one amendment is not a part of this.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Go ahead.
Gee, is there a intense feeling of dislike for the dash one, which would... make sure that one member was from each congressional district.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, that doesn't cause me heartburn. I noticed that in the dash two amendments, the language indicates appointments to the commission shall be made to ensure to the greatest extent possible geographic and ethnic representation of Asian Americans in Oregon. The dash one, if adopted, would just be a little more specific on the geographic requirements.
I wanted to ascertain that because I have a constituent that is on the commission that is very, very concerned that something like this be added. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I think we could accommodate geographic diversity, especially if there were Asian Americans that came to us and wanted us to do that. We try to accommodate those things. We do try to strive to geographic diversity, and we can do that without the dash one amendment, if you would prefer.
I think that you would prefer to have the dash one amendment in there. Mm-hmm. They would agree.
I would support that. I recall the testimony.
Mm-hmm. Okay. From governor's office that you just mentioned, you don't have any heartburn on the dash one amendment.
No, Mr. Chair, that's correct. We have other boards and commissions that require members serve from congressional districts.
Okay.
And it works very well.
Okay.
The one we just previously discussed.
Yes. Okay. And so do we have any objection? If dash one amendment adopted, then dash two must be changed also?
I think, Mr. Chair, that the committee could adopt both the dash one and the dash two, and legislative council would do another draft, melding the two together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we need to bring that up here again? Or?
I don't think we have that opportunity. I think we'll have to take the vote and present it to them.
Okay. So, do we have any objection to adopt the dash?
Are you in a public hearing?
No, I'm sorry. You have a public hearing. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any other person like to testify on Senate Bill 951? If not, we will close the public hearing, Senate Bill 951, and we are going to open a work session, Senate Bill 951. So,
Mr. Chair, I would, before Katie leaves the room, I would like to thank her on behalf of my constituents for being agreeable to this and the governor's office. Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 951 as and engrossed by dash two amendment.
Okay.
the days to
okay.
Correct, and engrossed by the days.
Would you mind repeating the motion?
Okay, I would recommend or move that we accept the Dash 1 amendment into the hand engrossed Dash 2 amended Senate Bill 951 and send it to the Senate for the due pass recommendation.
So we are at this time adopting Dash 1 and Dash 2 together at the same time then?
Yeah.
Okay, what is Senator Fisher that they move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to be a part of the Dash 2 amendment? Okay, any objection to adopt this amendment? Not this one. Then are we ready to have a work session then?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and going to move this case.
Okay.
No, then okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Senate Bill 951 as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments be sent to the Senate for the due pass recommendation.
Okay, the official move that the Senate Bill 951, Dash 1 and Dash 2, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, then that's it. We'll call you as soon as the council holds you.
Okay.
We'll see if you hear that. It's there.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to thank you for your accommodation on here. I know my constituents deeply appreciate this.
Yeah.
She's an extremely hardworking person and very interested in furthering the commitment to Asian affairs and the commission, and does a wonderful job down.
She looks like a good lady. Not only we are supporting you, but I am supporting it because it's a good thing in each congressional history. So we will see how it's going to work. Okay.
Senator
Corcoran, Senator Duncan. Aye. Senator Fisher. Aye. Senator Gordley. Aye. Senator Aye. Senate Bill 961 is amended. It's passed. And who is to carry this bill? Senator Fisher.
If I've got to do the other one, I just will do this one.
You have both in your hand, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. And with that, I need to close. Did I close the work session? Yes, I'd like to close the work session for Senate Bill 951. Okay, bear with me. I have just one more bill. I think this is a good bill. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 984. 948. Who is the chairman? Okay. Day four. Yeah. Please come. Before you check high, that the order to give us the what is it?
Very briefly, I can.
Yes, 951, right?
Senate Bill 948.
948, I'm sorry.
It comes to this committee as a referral from the Senate from the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It has no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but no statement has yet been issued. What this bill does is establish the Oregon State Box and Rescue Commission as an independent state agency. It is currently under the supervision of the Superintendent of State Police. And this bill transfers the duties and the functions from the state police to the commission. That's all.
Okay. Good day.
Yes.
Which one could you share with us?
My name is Dave Wolf. I own Dave Taekwondo here in Salem. I've been involved in martial arts for 30 years. And Senator Lynn and committee members, what I'm here to talk about is basically maybe some of the language that is used in here is some is ambiguous. As far as the boxing goes, what you have is you have boxing, which is full contact. Then you have other sporting events that have full contact in there. There's no language basically for the full contact. It basically says boxing, then it includes something that is similar to boxing, which is kickboxing. What I propose is basically maybe some language change to where The Boxing Commission is in charge of anyone who has or any activity or sporting event which has a knockout or as a full contact of the head as part of the language which would determine if they regulate that industry or not. And there are different types of martial arts tournaments, for example, anywhere from full contact to non-contact to light contact. The lesser ones do not require that you have a knockout to win, or if you do X amount of damage, you can be disqualified. So in there, I would like to look for some protection from the language to where it might stipulate that if a sporting event did not require or did not allow a knockout to be part of the requirement for winning, that they would not be subject to the Boxing Commission. In California, I'm relatively sure that what happens is the Boxing Commission regulates the martial arts tournaments, and they have changed a number of the ways in which it is dealt with, which hinders the training. For example, in a non-contact school, different schools get together and hold different martial arts tournaments for training and for other purposes, which would then be regulated by the Boxing Commission, which then means that you must be licensed, and there's all sort of requirements to that. So if you're looking for kickboxing, not necessarily as the people who train do not train to be martial artists, they train to be kickboxers for competition. So when someone is training for competition specifically, as opposed to what the total picture of the martial art would be, then maybe there should be some separation there. Also, in the language for wrestling, it is also unclear if you look at line 36, on page 2. It says wrestling includes any form of fighting other than the described in section 1 and of the section between contestants in which the contestants deliver blows to an opponent's body or apply holds to an opponent's body with the intent to punish, immobilize, or throw the opponent with the possible effect of rendering the opponent unable to continue the contest. In which case, what happens is that also falls into the line of a judo contest. So it's not necessarily wrestling then. It becomes then, do they encompass the whole of the martial arts or just the intended professional? And there is no language in there as opposed to what is going to happen with amateur boxing. Okay. Is this bill intended for professional or is it amateur? And then would it also encompass, for example, if you went into contestants that go full contact to the head with a knockout, then Senator Lim's bill that he's looking to pass for the martial arts would then fall subject to this one, the Boxing Commission, as opposed to. And now you have the Boxing Commission regulating all tournaments done by the USTU Olympics. So this is what I was here to talk about, and maybe see if there could be some amendment in the language.
Okay, what we are talking about, the bill already is in. What we are changing is a big, bold language.
Okay.
That's what we are doing. We're already
is this changing from the state police to the...
Yes, that's only the commission.
So no language can be changed at this time.
We could... But already in the statute in there, or what my proposal is to bring the from the state superintendent, that it leads to the governor's office. That's
right.
All it does.
Okay. Yes. So that's all it does. Okay.
Yes, that's all.
In which case, then I'm off to that too.
Okay.
Okay.
I think due to the time that we have to deal with these things over here in the Senate, there might be possibly something that could be done once it gets to the House between now and then, so I have amendments that could be looked at the House side, then they could be concurred or non-concurred when it came back to the Senate again. So you do have some time between here and now. We don't have much more time to do this. If we stop this thing from getting amendments, we won't get it out of the Senate and over the House. So if you really felt concerned about trying to put something into here and talking with the different people, where would this go on the other side in the House?
Yeah.
It'll take 3 or 4
I have the same feeling that this goes to the House,
mm-hmm.
and I like to work with you. Any changes need to be done in the body of the language, then let's do that in the House.
Okay.
So we have to pass out.
Sure.
Otherwise, we don't have time.
Sure. Okay. So what would be my next step? Would it be to set an appointment with someone?
Please call my office.
Okay.
And then anything you'd like to change, make it better.
Okay.
Give us a talk about it with my staff and any members, then we'll do that.
Okay. So the legislative council, we could have it all drawn up. So it'll be ready by the time we get over to the House.
Okay. So if I go to Senator Lims and then I go to
the preparation time can be utilized at the same time it's traveling through the process, but it'll be a couple, 3 days before it comes up, or a week before it comes up.
So I should get on this tomorrow or the next day.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes,
I'm sorry, I just had to be out there for...
Yeah.
The superintendent state police is supporting this?
Sure. No, I heard a testimony from this bill came from the Agriculture Department.
Yeah.
They are not opposing this bill.
Okay,
I came from the Committee of the Agriculture.
Okay. I have some.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I sat on the committee last year where this came up, and I still may have some reservations, so somebody may want to spend some time with me or something. I don't know, because I didn't go for the change they were trying to get last year, and I don't know where I'm listening.
Already? Thank you.
I would just like to thank you for your patience because you sat through each and every one of the previous hearings and work sessions, and I would be interested in hearing your observations about the process and how it works, how it works for you. If you can say that in a few minutes.
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh, I find it interesting. I think that regardless of how big a bill is, everything has its importance, and it makes this little wave. I think that when your job is done correctly, as I saw today, I think that it's fair and impartial. I think it had good both sides of pros and cons from the senators. And so I thought it was very, if there's something that is not looked at very well, I think you do a very fine job of looking at it.
You know, there's nothing done here because we have a public process, pro and con discuss it, and even we debate the Senate, and even after that, it was House debate again, and the whole thing was.
And I'll probably follow one of these.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any person like to testify on Senate Bill 948? If not, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 948. Open our work session on Senate Bill 948.
Are we very smooth for this one?
This changes it from state police to its own commission.
If members notice in the background information, there is the Senate Bill 238 and the agriculture changes that basically change.
What I'd like to do, if there's any concern, I'd like to work with you if possibly any change in the House.
Well, do you have the votes to send it out now without me?
Sorry.
Okay, so we were serving at the Agriculture Department. We heard the testimony on this bill from the Agriculture Department.
I will provide a courtesy vote. I will not be voting for the bill.
Okay.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair?
Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 948 to the Senate floor with a blue pass recommendation.
And position move to Senate Bill 948 to the floor with a blue pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, call the roll.
Senator Corcoran, Senator Duncan?
No.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
Senator Gorsuch?
Aye.
Senator Lund?
Aye.
Senate Bill 948, and I will carry the bill.
Okay.
And then if there's no other business, then we adjourn. Yes, I'd like to close then at 9:48. Work session closed, right? And then if there's no other business, then we adjourn. Thank you.
You might have done it.
We moved. I'm going to do it twice.
This is the best move.
I think we moved the car up here.
We have a heavy agenda.
Where can I take him also?
Not a night.